This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thanks, Aaron. What? I'll stand. I'll move stand just a little. I don't know if I can live up to my blurb, though. Let's see. The works of Adolf Loos are commonly taken as desentimentalizing instances of an early modern iconoclasm that, if not outright nihilistic, was out to deny art as such and proved all the braver for it, as if some practically Dadaist form of anti-architecture. Loos's work is even referred to the logical positivism of the Vienna Circle, with its nullification of whatever could be accused of being metaphysical. Loos did notoriously remark that architecture, or at least the house, should not be a matter of art, though, as with Nietzsche, it would be dangerous to lose sight of the ironist's being ironic. Rather than contend with the terms of the happy nihilist position, however, I want to open up the question by teasing out Loos's artfulness, especially by comparison with works in other modes that are unequivocally works of art, even works of art by knowledgeable, if still not common, consensus, beautiful. No need to pursue the old worries about beauty in respect of art, if only because to a hardcore anti-art Loosian, Loos's buildings are ugly and better than nice. First on the left and right, please. The easiest way to justify Loos's architecture as art would simply be to refer it back to the classical tradition as one more installment of the perennial classical truth. As I say this, I show for appropriate mood music Loos's early Villa Karma near Montreux in Switzerland, begun as a remodeling project in 1904 and abandoned in 1906, side by side with one of the masterworks of the Renaissance, Giuliano da Sangalla's Medici Villa at Poggio Arcaiano, designed in the early 1480s. Let's just say that nobody would deny that this Italian Renaissance villa is beautiful, notwithstanding compositional peculiarities, and probably few would deny that juxtaposed with it, Loos's early villa looks curiously similar, and not ironically either. In view of the struggle to overthrow academically established classicism in architecture, alongside the presumption of pictorial representation in painting, there would be something hopelessly reactionary in claiming that whatever artistic truth Loos's work contained was by virtue all along of just whatever it never really managed to overthrow. I do not think the romantic classical and subsequent 19th century Biedermeier styles, which I'll comment on, have bearing. I do think that they have bearing on Loos, though I do not think it helpful to charge as much as possible to the classical account. The main thing is that Loos did not throw out the baby of art with the bathwater of the academic notion of superadded ornament, classical or otherwise, which had validated even otherwise quite artless buildings as architectural art. To some extent, the problem concerns the development of forgivably anti-aesthetic, utilitarian, so-called functionalist thinking of marked social motivation, notably in Czechoslovakia in the 1920s. But though the Czech-born Viennese Loos eventually became a kind of godfather of Czech functionalism, his work in theory and practice was influential, but he did not reduce architecture to functionalist utilitarian determinism himself. Certainly his mature notion of a Raum plan, a spatial plan, which required an engineer collaborator just so as to have the floors of rooms on arbitrarily different levels with extraordinary and expensive structural complications, violates functional practicality. The next on both sides, please. On simple terms, Loos's Haus Schur in Vienna of 1912-14 with a 1928 Czech functionalist house by Ulrich Starý at Brno in Moravia, which is Loos's hometown. In this case, the stepped profile of terraced roofs in Loos's work is boldly syntactically foregrounded, vis-a-vis the earnest, plain-speak blandness of the equivalent feature of its later typical Czech functionalist counterpart. Next pair, please. Here, quickly, are two more subtler examples. The rectangular opening at the upper corner of the exterior of Loos's Villa Müller in Prague of 1928-30 versus the much tamer roof porch of a house in Prague, Zimtschow, 1925-26. And the finely, next pair on both sides, the finely articulated post and lintel roof trellis of Loos's Vintonitz house. In both cases, you're looking at the Vintonitz house of Loos here. This is a close-up of this. Versus, next on the right, the then already built but run-on roof terrace framing of Bohuslav Fuchs' public baths at Brno in 1927. In other words, these formal properties, which are so punchy in Loos's works, where he's foregrounding them as abstract motifs, you might say, are picked up and neutralized or commonized in a way, you know, in the discourse of functionalism. But they're not functionalists to begin with. They're art, see? And still people who should know better take Loos's de-ornamentalized simplicity at the start of so-called Bauhaus functionalism. For good social as well as polemical reasons, dyed-in-the-wool Czech functionalists who often said that what they were doing was not art were as anti-formalist in the 1920s as American minimalist sculptors would prove to be in the 1960s. My aesthetic defense of Loos is admittedly formalistic, but I hope its formalism has deeper groundings than the standing caricature of latter-day American art criticism. I remember discovering it at the wellspring of the early modern Bloomsbury formalism of Roger Fry and Clive Bell, firsthand and from teachers already influenced by them, only to develop later as my generation gained access to Russian formalism and to Prague linguistic thought. In retrospect, I find that the most serious misunderstanding about modernist formalism at large concerns the appeal not of mere shape, however materially integral, but of manifest structural relations. Possibly nothing is more definitively modernist than the notion that relations between things are just as real and at least as significant as the elements standing in relation. Against this rose the deliberately numb, formal self-evidence of latter-day minimalist sculpture, which itself was often made in new awareness of early Soviet formalism, as well as in negation of simplistic contemporary American formalism, and which I shall look at momentarily. Actually, the theoretical attention to relations per se was a hallmark of the great analytical project of early 20th century British culture, not only in the art critical thinking of Fry and Bell. I would go as far as to say that when Fry admires a Chinese pot for its form, his attending detachedly to the profile alone, supposedly a singular thing, of even a simple unadorned vessel, is at base an active attending to relations between the curves of the pot's sides, if not even of the dual or plural curves of each side, while, as it were, holding such relations in suspension. Bertrand Russell, pleased to recognize relations as, quote, pure forms, symbolizable as XRY, meaning X has the relation R to Y, writes in 1919, the form of a proposition is that in it that remains unchanged when every constituent of the proposition is replaced by another. The Bloomsbury-attuned Keynes, in a 1938 letter, criticizes another economist's mistaken tendency to seek to substantiate economic models by granting them specific quantitative values, quote, by filling in the figures. Keynes writes, which one can be quite sure will not apply next time. So far from increasing the value of his instrument, he has destroyed it. Keynes's point is not that econometric models should not have empirical grounding, but that to stand as models, they had best assume the abstracted form of pure relations. My reason for reconnecting with the early 20th century fundament of formalism is that twice, first with the architectural functionalism of the 1920s and 30s, and then with the sculptural minimalism of the 1960s and 70s, the essentially aesthetic and intuitive appealing engagement of formal relations, especially conspicuously asymmetrical formal relations, symmetrical ones being generally inert, was programmatically repudiated by self-declared non-artistic functionalist architects and minimalist, quote, object makers, precisely as, quote, formalistic. On its own terms, I am quite interested in orthodox functionalism. And I hope it does not seem as though I eschew the anti-formal, willfully non-relational art of the minimalists, who were responsible for much excellent art in my generation, just because I am concerned about its problematic construal today. Elsewhere, next pair, please, both sides. Elsewhere, I have likened an architectural detail by Loos, part of a staircase in the Mahler House in Vienna of 1928, on the left, with a minimalist sculpture by Tony Smith, Free Ride, 1962, to elucidate a similarity of only slightly inflected elemental form to comparably cool effect. In its heyday, minimalism held such massive conviction that it had an almost gravitational way of subsuming onto itself anything stripped down and elemental in form, regardless of where it was coming from. Hence, the tendency of the next generation to mistake even pure abstract paintings as, quote, minimal, a category that by rights precludes aesthetic articulation. Next pair, please. Here, for example, is a juxtaposition of a formalistic abstract sculpture, strongly relational as a balanced asymmetrical configuration, David Smith's Q by 10 of 1963 in the Museum of Modern Art, side by side with a typical anti-formalist minimalist sculpture by Tony Smith, Die, 1962, a 6-foot plate steel cube simply too unitary, uninflected, and formally self-evident to be considered a composition at all. In a nutshell, Loos is closer to David Smith's Cubi than now tends to be assumed, even if the Czech functionalists are closer to Tony Smith's Die. Next on the right, please. Now consider one of the minimalist sculptures of Carl André, Untitled, 1965, of cast cement blocks. It was, next on the left, please. It was a brick piece by André that caused a famous ritual ruckus when it was bought by the British nation for the Tate Gallery in 1972. But that is not what we have on the left. It happens that there is a minimalist by the name of Robert Morris. But what I show beside the André is an engraved illustration by a different Robert Morris, a British architect of the mid-18th century. On the widest terms, this is a case of those formal, if not necessarily semiotic, affinities between 18th century, more or less specifically classical rationalist form, and 20th century, specifically abstract, in one way or another rationalist form. The 18th century Morris's illustration in his Lectures on Architecture, 1734 to 36, was designed to show how variously proportioned architectural volumes could be built up from unit cubes. And because that does sound quasi-minimal, it is worth noting that this plate was reproduced and discussed by Emil Kaufmann in his Architecture in the Age of Reason, 1955, which in a Dover reprint of 1968 interjected itself, I recall, right into the minimalist shakeup, where not only the Morris but the sublimely simple architectural geometries of Boulez and Ledoux, which only art history had cared about, were suddenly part of poker-faced minimalism's mise-en-scene. What is critically crucial in juxtaposition is the particular relational putting forth of hypothetical volumes in terms of pure proportions of so many units by so many units by so many units versus uninflected, a barely arithmetic physical stacking of chunky unitary blocks and repetitious tiers. The next pair, please. Internal relationalism, or lack of it, is more important than whether externally an artwork be ontologically unique or instanced in multiple, there being entire categories of art in which multiple originals are common, all numismatics, all prints, as well as much minimalist sculpture. In terms of non-relationality, two works by Don Judd, both of course untitled, testify in different ways. The earlier piece from 1964 presses a limit of inert non-compositional shape. The second, a relief, effects an incremental symmetry, as in music or mathematics, whereby as solid elements decrease, equivalent voids increase, making for a self-evident order that rules out formal fuss. Not so dissimilarly, Czech functionalism was on strike against formalism, but Loos was a subtle formalist, notwithstanding his iconoclastic bluster, and his works make formal assertions, restrained as their social deportment may be. All this concerns the reception of Loos today because it has become common to consider Loos himself as, quote, minimalist, even to admire him for it, though wrongly enough on more than one historical count. While there are indeed background reasons why Loos's spare, no-nonsense, anti-ornamental art should have been interpreted or misinterpreted as an aesthetic of negativity, an anti-architecture or art to end art in a nihilistic sense, there is reason to inquire into the formal aspect of his work, which can be negotiated in some measure in terms of the commonly presumed formally insignificant or merely functionally determined fenestration of his buildings. Those arrays, however intentionally composed, of rectangular wall openings, which are perhaps not so gratuitous, let alone anesthetic. Next pair, please. After a generation of not only anti-formalism but widespread anti-modernism, even many well-read people today cannot tell the difference or else seek to avoid the complication of acknowledging the difference between, on one hand, such an art as Loos's engaging, subtly formal intuitions and either the minimalist sang-froid of Bauhaus and other functionalist and geometric constructivist art, or the later willfully simplistic, dumb, mute, stubbornly uninflected art against art of minimalist object-making. To speak of the Bauhaus is to invoke that great art school of the Weimar Republic, especially in the new home that Walter Gropius designed for it in 1925-26. I think it was finished in 1928, though, which has become so symbolic of modernism in the strength of not exactly its youthful, but more its ephebic and militant phase, a phase of optimistically materialist world-building constructivism. The question is whether the work, the art, of Loos tends toward this pole and advances a, quote, death of architecture or of the fine arts or of art and all, at all and as such. And if so, whether that would be any reason to have a party. You can tell that I don't think so. In some sense, the problem of impassive minimalist anti-aestheticism was indeed adumbrated in the utilitarian functionalist architecture of Gropius and his associate Adolf Meyer, but also from early on of the severe functionalists of Czechoslovakia, who sternly girded their loins against the temptations of formalism, not to mention Soviet constructivists whose loins were girded for them against the same supposed bourgeois temptation. Not necessarily out of expediency, but because to all concerned, a purgation of the decadent orthodox formalism of academic classicism was in order, it was forgivable to speak as though one's building were not art at all. And if latter-day minimalist sculpture never purported to be utilitarian, while early functionalist architecture held its utilitarianism high, in extreme form neither was a simplification in the interest of aesthetic beauty. Not that the practitioner of either would be disappointed to have the history of art come around, and not that that would necessarily be hypocritical either. Despite its accommodation to the factory system, the whole Bauhaus idea of a new art made socially useful owes much to William Morris's putting into arts and crafts practice of his insights of, in effect, early Marxist alienation theory. While the matter of the Bauhaus is on the table, I wish to make a few remarks that may advance the critical understanding of Loos. For one of the most confusing things about Loos's swashbuckling theoretical writings is that while you can tell that he thinks the cult of crafts a complete farce, he also thinks that just about the only person you can trust to make a, dare we say, beautiful object is any craftsman as yet unperverted by art. Or, because, as Nietzsche might point out, we are not going to get anywhere with this by playing dumb, what people wrongly consider to be the art in art. When Kandinsky and Clay were called to teach at this great school, where there were no faculty ranks except master, in the proud craft sense of master carpenter, they had to deal every day with something that is still rarely discussed. That because painting is the art in which the most negligible material so readily makes for the most unimpeded formal, makes the most unimpeded formal claims, painting tends, conditions being usual, to have an inside track on whatever people want or don't want to call, as Kandinsky earlier had, the spiritual in art. Although geistlich is easier to get away with in educated German than spiritual seems to be in present-day English, everybody in the Bauhaus, weavers and joiners and potters included, and no hard feelings either, would have understood that though Kandinsky and Clay had something worthwhile to convey to their students besides how to mix rabbit skin glue, spiritual value was simply not to be demanded of a decent upholstery fabric, a good solid chair, or most respectable pots. An equivalent je ne sais quoi is more difficult to track with Loos, who, however, even helped to make the Bauhaus possible by his architecture as well as by his theoretical work. Next on the right, please. Consider our Czech-born Viennese modernist's 1931 idea for his own tombstone. A drawing which has become notorious in that its brute blocky mass might seem nihilistic or minimal, and also that might even be appealing or at least entertaining. Taking it thusly presumes that Loos's sketch is simply a hurried, excusably inaccurate rendering of an otherwise regular categorical cube. Left, please. I raise this doubt in subversive good faith, wondering just how sloppy we can assume a sketch by a known fanatic to be, because if for a moment we consider it on its own formal terms, there opens a potential analogy between its asymmetrically chamfered projected form and that to some embarrassingly transcendental masterpiece by Malevich, strongly influenced by the Russian Orthodox icon tradition, Suprematist painting White on White from 1918, with its ultra-intuitive, anything but minimal, slight but crucial deviations from squareness, orthogonality, and right angularity. This possibility would not be surprising if the funereal cube had nothing formally in common with the pared-down blocks of even Loos's domestic buildings, possibly not without self-caricature, which I propose to entertain in the context of modern painting. About the writings, suffice it to say that in the notorious Ornament and Crime essay of 1908, the dates of these essays are in dispute, but there's no reason to be detained by that, when virtually all literate adults still assumed that ornament was just what set architecture above mere building as fine art, Loos takes the lust for ornament as symptomatic of a lack of sublimatory cultivation, as with enthusiasm for tattooing among guilty criminals as well as innocent primitive folk. And that in architecture, which used to be dated 1910, he preaches quite against architecture as art, which by itself would only require the grain of salt that he meant architecture as he then found it, in a culturally corrupt turn-of-the-century bourgeois condition. In terms of the aesthetic affirmation of simplicity, the generally spiffy, squared-away boxiness of Loos's work, I am suggesting, though it did have a certain proto-functionalist role as paleo-formally inspiring to functionalists who didn't want to belabor form, has too often been presumed functionalist in itself. Next pair on both sides, please. Hence, by rights, anti-formal, if not proto-minimalistically anti-formalist. Its very simplicity, however, finds historical adumbration in that widely disseminated, homier variant of the elegantly restrained and classical simplicity of the Central European Goethezeit, but all the more in the hand-me-down middle-class version, that popular mid-19th century style of art and, sorry Adolf, decor, known as the Biedermeier. Loos's early Museum Café in Vienna of 1899, still today a proudly hip place, we are looking at the wing of an L-plan that used to be the billiards hall, was hardly at odds at the end of the 19th century with the charmingly bracing, unpretentious rectitude of, say, Rudolf von Alt's watercolor of a peasant room in Siebenstein, painted in 1853. The folkly politeness of the Biedermeier, as regionally given, is semi-obvious substrate to Loos's revisionist enthusiasm for suave 18th century English Chippendale and plain Jane Anglo-American Windsor chairs. Later projects show more problematic formal aspects. Next on the right, please. A work that deserves special attention because so many generalizations take off from it is the 1910 Steiner House in suburban Vienna. This textbook warhorse, however, has overlooked formal properties in common with modernist abstract painting, all the more for a work purportedly, for rhetorical purposes at least, non-fine arts architecture, especially a formally interesting asymmetry as deliberately offsetting symmetry, as pointed and telling and compositionally engrossing, anything but accidental or trivial. Next on the left, please. One way of getting at the aesthetic appeal of the Steiner House is to see it in light of a less disputable contemporary work of Viennese modernist art, Water Castle, painted just a year or two before the building of the Steiner House in 1908-09 by Gustav Klimt, Loos's 8-year older contemporary and the first president of the Vienna Secession. Loos lashed out against the smug superficiality of decorative art, and the secession itself, for that matter, though in a sense this was A, a cut above, and B, home. In Klimt's landscape, there is, it is true, a decoratively convenient agreement of all the architectural planes as frontal in the famous formalist picture plane. More than that, however, which as Loos might have noted would satisfy a designer of linoleum, these architectural planes are punctuated as singly and twinned in an irregular but rhythmic balance by black rectangular windows and other openings set in the plain stuccoed walls of typical Central European buildings, typical even in palely evoking the ever slightly Italian-looking Kaisergelb or Imperial Austrian yellow, plus a small gray structure with two pairs of rectangular openings and looking like a duck blind in the foliage at the water's edge. All the black rectangles, as well as all the different but agreeing white and yellow planes, constitute a contented asymmetrical, basically rectilinear unity. In the Steiner House and later domestic works of Loos, one can discover a lively play between a definite frontal symmetry and a decided asymmetry in the fenestration of side walls. The major facade of the Steiner House is the downhill garden face, that's it there on the right, of a house whose smaller and more modest uphill street facade is also symmetrical. It is in contradistinction that the asymmetrical fenestration of the flank of the building becomes all the more compositionally compelling, especially as invoking a disjunction overcome at the corner. Against the tendency to take the ironical Loos's words at face value, I would stress how strong this aspect of his houses is, how much the artistic effect depends on the asymmetrical fenestration of the flanks over and against the more formal symmetrical facades as a matter of artfully asymmetrical relational composition. Now, art historically, discrepancy between symmetrical facade and unarticulated flanks had been for Heinrich Wulfflin a practically semiotic trait of the post-Renaissance Baroque. The Baroque was not interested in an organic articulation of the body of the church, writes Wulfflin in Renaissance and Baroque, 1888. Employing a physiognomic metaphor, the sides of the building were completely neglected, not even faced. All the effort was concentrated on the head, and the other limbs were barely indicated. Next pair, please. Less than a decade after Wulfflin's observation, and only 15 or so years before the Steiner House, painting offers a lesson in the artistic potential of deviation from regularity and fenestration in the form of a beautifully stark pencil and watercolor drawing by Cézanne of an industrial building in the country. We gain some leverage on how just the right irregularity in such configurations can be aesthetically engaging from this work of the 1890s, long known as Moulin au Pont des Trois Sautés, Millet de Pont des Trois Sautés. As the building no longer stands, we are fortunate, left please, to be able to compare Cézanne's realization of it, as he liked to say, with a photograph of the structure taken by John Rewald in the 1930s. Cézanne, a modernist on record as despising industrial and commercial encroachment on the countryside, the invasion of the bipeds, he called it, approaches the unprepossessing small industrial structure head-on. Like so many painters from Mondrian to Ellsworth Kelly, who have welcomed the concrete plane geometry of facades seen frontally into their planar compositions. Basically, the fenestration of the mill's big unrelieved wall looks to have consisted of a bilateral grid, with the position of the top window of the first bay blank, like a musical rhythm that starts with a rest. Tellingly, with only slight adjustments, Cézanne's rendition of the fenestration seems to break free in the watercolor, as if grappling with the grid in rigorously calibrated deviations from the given axes, these gently disrupting overall orthogonality. No doubt Cézanne would have appreciated the loosened up asymmetrical fenestration of the Steiner flank, just around the corner from the symmetrical formality of its garden facade. That Rewald came to identify the building in question not as a mill but as a lime kiln and retitled the work, thusly, is interesting in view of Loos, insofar as it implies that at least some of the interior space might, for industrial purpose, have been more than one regular story high, which would in turn imply that the anonymous builder, himself avoided deviation from regularity in his supposedly frankly industrial structure. Whereas Loos would develop the notion of the Raum plan or spatial planning, allowing in domestic architecture for room spaces of different heights with windows irregularly disposed. Here it is as if Cézanne, who had inherited his father's Jade de Buffon estate with its patriarchal house as boxy in a bourgeois classical mode as this utilitarian lime kiln, seemingly took such an interest in the redaction of the given structure on its own artistic terms. Earl Loran published another Rewald photograph of the motif and the drawing in his influential Cézanne's composition, 1943, with the comment, "Through simplification and elimination, Cézanne achieves a mysterious lyrical quality deriving from the abstract organization of static planes." But while one wants to approve the artist's structural approbation, Cézanne's, if anything, astute complication by supplementation of the very neutral given architectural composition cannot be rationalized as, quote, simplification and elimination. As if Loran had been taking a page in 1948 from a certain post-war intellectual popularity of functionalism. In view of Loos, Cézanne's lime kiln does give cause to doubt that significant architectural asymmetries enjoying an equilibrium not inertly presumed but attained against odds, that such asymmetries down to the asymmetry doctrinally declared in architectural modernism are mere denials of classically presumed symmetrical order. On the aesthetic front, there is the question of how, well beyond the picturesque, asymmetry may be formally and structurally significant. At least since Johann Friedrich Herbart, early in the 19th century, aesthetics was prepared not merely to warrant asymmetry, but to allow that what sometimes seems a quasi-theological sense of rectification, of which I, for one, am often put in mind before classic neoplastic painting by Mondrian. Mondrian, and quite possibly Loos too, would have liked Herbart's propounding in his introductory textbook of philosophy of 1813, a principle of, quote, departure from symmetrical relations, so that one can, quote, lose regularity in order to win it back again on the spot. Next on the right, please. The building that really put Loos on the cultural map a decade later, in 1909-11, was the combination haberdashery for Goldman and Szilagyi with apartments above, known as the Loos House, at the site of which most of Vienna put on chagrin on behalf of Emperor Franz Joseph, next on the left, please, who lived directly across the Michaeliplatz in the imperial apartments in the block called the Michaelitracht, which had been designed in the 18th century but was only just recently built, 1889-93. Of course, it was the shamelessly unadorned simplicity, undressed in Loosian terms, of the unrelieved gridded fenestration of the whole upper facade that had everybody in a tizzy. A well-known journalistic cartoon compared it with a storm drain grate. By and large, the population was invested in just the uppity ornamental schmaltz that passed as high art, which Loos frankly hated and mocked. Next on the left, please. That the building echoes in some measure the regular fenestration bending almost to a corner over a recessed Doric porch in Baldassare Peruzzi's mannerist Palazzo Massimo della Colonna in Rome, begun in 1532, is no doubt a rather arcane point, unless one wanted to pursue the modernist relevancy of mannerism as hyperformalism. Next on the left, please. Had they cared, however, the burghers of Vienna might have taken the Loos House too on happy quasi-Biedermeier terms, in analogy, for example, with a practically as spare office building with chaste Doric porch built likewise on the corner of a tapering site a century earlier in 1808 for a publishing house in Brunswick, Germany, by David Gilly, teacher of the famous arch-classicist Carl Friedrich Schinkel. Apparently, it was more important not to pass up the opportunity for an anti-modern stink. The next on the left, please. The Loos House is by no means artless. Something never remarked about Loos's design is its curious resemblance to a work by a modern painter of such refinement that no one would ever read his work in such terms of impertinence as the Loos House was supposed to project, namely Pierre Bonnard, who produced this color lithograph titled Les Boulevards in 1900, several years before the Loess House. In Bonnard's image, thinly bracing as afternoon tea, a large, looming commercial building, quite similar to the Loess House, is part of the charm, un-outrageously enough. Whether Bonnard invented his principal motif or endowed with elegance and simplicity the facade of some actual building, likewise facing onto a place, the result is an aesthetic urbanity worthy of Baudelaire, Zimmel, or Benjamin. Next on both sides, please. I would also suggest, in line with connections already made by Loessians tracing American influences owed to Loess's stay here as a young man, and Philadelphia was actually looked at before he returned to New York to study it, by noting that the crisp, unmodulated conjunction of cylindrical columnar and boxy beam forms in the lower commercial part of the building recalls the like interplay of forms in Louis Sullivan's Guarantee Building in Buffalo of 1894-95. Which is to say, contemporaneously with the Hofburg's pseudo-18th century Michaela Trocht face, just the part everybody purported to love. The Loess House still seems to be the favorite of those who might be prepared to deal with the modernists' scandal and can appreciate the idea pioneered in architecture by Loess with his anti-ornamentalism and proclaimed by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe that less might somehow prove more, but who don't really believe that this sort of thing ever really makes the earth move for anybody, as with those who ever insist that nobody really digs Schoenberg's music. Partly the Loess House must be easier to deal with because, especially in the rigorously gridded fenestration of its upper stories, it avoids the complication or the subtlety of asymmetry, especially of asymmetry coexisting with symmetry. So let us spend a minute on formal relational asymmetry with the help of Mondrian and two further Loess examples. On the right, please. First, however, I place side by side with the charmingly casual asymmetry of the street facade of Loess's little house Horner, also in Vienna, of 1912. Next on the left, a Gothic wall so barely penetrated by openings that one hesitates to consider this a fenestrational configuration at all. All the more because since the Renaissance, the Gothic has been understood from both sides of the matter as the major antithesis of classical hypertaxis, even as utterly anarchic. Not every configuration, of course, even every classical one, is significant. But I adduce this barely windowed wall of a castle keep in Ireland, I think of the 12th or 13th century, as something more than a nil instance. If one is so inclined, one can mentally construe a few common orthogonals between the sides of the various openings, if not without a sense of going out of the way in doing so. Next on the left, please. But compared with this configuration, Loess's facade has the fully orchestrated asymmetrical unity of, for instance, the floating and grazing rectangles of Mondrian's composition in Color B, 1917. With House Rufer, on the right, please, of 1922, also in Vienna, square facades with altogether different but both relationally asymmetric fenestration, on the left, join at the corner like a brace of compatibly different Mondrian compositions of the 1920s. Indeed, in the 1920s, when so-called classic Mondrian is juxtaposed with classic Loess, it seems that besides the subordination of the hypotactical in conventional classical composition, above all in axial symmetry, and anything goes paratactical structures of either functionalist or vernacular sort, there is perhaps another sort of order, as comprehensive as the hypotactical, but enjoying a freer, more paratactical variation of compounded elements. In other words, orderliness without subordination. Next on the right, please. The Mahler House in Vienna of 1928 has posed a peculiar problem ever since the fad for superficial architectural semiotics picked up and ran with somebody's quip, I don't really want to remember whose, that this facade looks just like a big face. Get it? Whether that means that the doorway is puckered and dimpled, one may decide for oneself. But I must say that this phenomenon goes to show how desperate some people evidently are after 100 years of modernism for representation. taking the tedious trope for what it is worth, as a remark on architectural physiognomy, as Wolflin himself had said, we judge every object by analogy with our own body, ought at least, left, please, to encourage seeing how interestingly this flank of the building is positively asymmetrical by comparison. And if one looks up from the same corner, there is almost a roofer house continuity in the regular plus irregular equals meta-irregular rhythm of the windows from the front to the side. Next pair, please. Then there is the late Müller house, built with the engineer Lothar in Prague, which dates to 1930. Something of a crucial moment in painting. A symmetrical, plastically articulated downhill front looks out over the city, while a very flat side street wall seems to equivocate in outline and fenestration between symmetry and asymmetry, reasonably enough for a flank that also faces onto a street. A flank that also faces onto a street. Next on the left, please. And on the right, too. The entrance facade, here, uphill and behind, the entrance facade, uphill and behind, confronts the street less plastically and almost asymmetrically. Note particularly in the fenestration a missing upper right-hand window, like the missing upper left-hand window we noticed in Cézanne's watercolor. Next on the left, please. The preparatory drawings for this fascinating, almost but not quite symmetrical facade have been published, and they show that, notwithstanding whatever determination was owed to the disposition of the interior round plan, and despite interference by the municipal authorities, the Cézanne-esque irregularity was composed as such by Loos. Meanwhile, next on the right, please. The private garden side bursts with formal plasticity, lurching outward with doubled mass below, while cutting mass away to nothing up above, not unlike Mondrian's way of settling an empty white strip on par with color compartments against a painting's edge. I have suggested that right around the time of the Müller House in 1930, at the end of Loos's career, something problematic happened in painting, which concerns Mondrian, but by no means only him. While the state of the world was now less than hospitable to transcendental abstract form, a forthrightly materialistic international constructivism did have something else to say that made, if anything, for easier alliances between painting and architecture and design. The next pair, please. Walter Gropius and Maxwell Fry's domestic complex at 66 Old Street, London of 1936, with Ben Nicholson's contemporary painting, 1936, here in Philadelphia. Design as such is so much the point that painting and building look like products of the same software program, not uninterestingly. Of possible conclusions, now, to these speculations on the significance especially of asymmetrical equilibrium as effected by Loos in the 1920s, the one that appeals to me concerns symmetry as a stubbornly classical presumption, not to say obsession, whereas so much great modernist architecture and painting of just that time manages to seem as good as classical while being freely asymmetrically disposed. In other words, it matters to seem as good as classical without having to fall back on classical symmetry. At best, as in Loos and Mondrian, one has the Kantian feeling of seeing something pulled off out of the freedom of artistic genius that seems so orderly that it should have had to be done by rule. Next on the right, please. I don't think it was ever the sheer so-called minimal boxiness alone of Loos's houses that bothered the non-modernists. After all, what could be boxier than Carl Friedrich von Schinkel's little pavilion at Schloss Charlottenburg outside Berlin? But I do think the solution to the problem is closer at hand, being the fallback or default Hellenism, ever so assuagingly orderly, never so assuagingly orderly as since the rise of industrialism. Next on the left, please. I think we modernists have looked too often at the same Schinkel textbook masterpiece, the Berlin Altes Museum of 1828 to 30. Next on the right, please. especially, I would add, in relation to Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. No doubt because, and the next on both sides, please. No doubt because Mies so conveniently alluded to it with his own Neue Nationalgalerie in Berlin, built in the 1960s. Maybe, after all, the Schinkel problem and the problematic chronic presumption of classical symmetry is the most conspicuous form of a great mistake. The next on the left, please. I think there has been something wrong all along with presuming that everything is classical insofar as it compares with the Parthenon. In fact, I have long suspected that it is something in modern art that has conveyed, the next pair, please, a more elusive classical truth and not the other way around. In support of this, finally, witness from art's great random access memory that overshadowed neighbor of the Parthenon, the Erechtheum, built only a decade or so later, towards the end of the 5th century. Loos once projected a house inspired by the Erechtheum, as well as projecting classical symmetrical buildings. But in light of his accomplished works, I am struck by the pertinence of this splendidly idiosyncratic classical work, so winningly asymmetrical from every side, even in its vertical displacements. Next on the right, please. Yes, these vertical, that one, and now another one on the right. These vertical displacements, which offer an amazing analogy with Adolf Loos's round plan of varying floor levels, and also, finally, next on the right, in its very ground plan. How reinforcing, after composing the present paper, to happen upon a text titled A Guide to the Anti-Classical Code, 1973, in which the modernist architectural historian Bruno Zevi, criticizing the rhetorical tendency of symmetrical buildings to be, quote, symbols of totalitarian power or products of sloth or cynicism, offers as a counterexample that was just not easy enough for academic classicists to co-opt, quote, the Erechtheum, a quite irregular and asymmetrical building, so modern that in a way it is a forerunner of Adolf Loos's multi-level round plan. Thanks. Okay. Yes. Yes.
Is that because it would seem to confound a little too much of this?
The question is about the about Loos's famous entry to the 1922 competition for a skyscraper to house the offices of the Chicago Tribune. And basically my answer to your question is yes, that one reason why I didn't want to play that card is that, in a sense, it seems too easy to play. But because it's an entire skyscraper in the form of a single Doric column. But I've actually composed an essay on that subject, because the more I think about it, the more interestingly ambiguous I think it is. It's dead serious, and it's also hilarious at the same time, you know? In other words, it's some kind of a joke. You can't look at it with a straight face, but it's also, in some way, theory packed into a building, you know? It's about the whole idea of the classical. It's also about what a very sophisticated guy from a provincial culture who already had to contend with an empire, then left Europe and then came here. And then, as I said, I think there's a remark that I make in the essay on the column where it says, because I think Sullivan is very interesting, the moment when he arrived here, and he did go to Philadelphia first, and there's something by him, there's something by Sullivan that he saw with round windows. But anyway, the point is that he left Vienna, which he'd sort of come to as a provincial from Prague, and actually from Brno, which is even more provincial. That's like coming from Jersey, you know? And so he arrives here like a clean slate, right? Except what does he run into? Another Otto Wagner, you know? Because everybody's all excited about this guy, Louis Sullivan, who is such a hipster, and what he's doing is reforming ornament, just like Professor Wagner, Just what he, you know? So I think that that's also part of the problem of the Los. It means so many things. But to give it its due, it means so many things, but it means them all very clearly and sharply. It's a great work. Yeah. You don't have to know what it looks like. It's just a column. Yes.
I wanted to respond to your characterizations in passing of Czech architecture, specifically Czech functionalism, because I felt that your argument on Los's asymmetry was very compelling, and as such, maybe didn't need an opponent, perhaps even a straw opponent, mm-hmm, that you put up in the form of this commonized, as you said, or banalized functionalism. Mm-hmm. It looks like you've been to Prague and other places in the Czech Republic from
a little.
The slides. Mm-hmm. And so, but this is something I happen to know a bit about, and so I know that at the time in the 20s when functionalism takes over there is great debate as to the principles of art and building in functionalism there, and there are only really three people who are as hardline as you say the group was in general, and one of them never built anything but only wrote theory.
Taiga.
That's Carl Taiga. Mm-hmm. And in fact his own book designs, mm-hmm, which are some sort of on paper equivalent of functionalist building, are in mm-hmm fact highly asymmetrical, so
that's right,
they would tend to support your argument, mm-hmm, but your argument about Los, not against Czech functionalism. Mm-hmm. So, and many of the buildings themselves do have some asymmetry, and it's just interesting in a way, you know, most people celebrate the existence of, let's say, 50 functionalist buildings as an mm-hmm unusual triumph, but you call mm-hmm it a commonization.
I'd like to take back the word commonization because it was completely extemporaneous and somewhat ill-considered, especially in the light of your criticism. Because let me say first that I feel like I'm very much in the works with Czech functionalism, and I like it a lot. And I didn't mean to make it just the fall guy or the straight man for Los. In fact, there's going to be another chapter on that. But the easy part of the question to answer is that what theoretically fascinates me about the problem of Czech functionalism is it's like a problem that we have outgrown with photography, because there used to be endless arguments about whether photography is art or not. You know, and I had a little theory at the time that, like during the last rounds of this, that one reason why nobody was getting anywhere philosophically with this was that there were four possibilities and not two, because it's not just yes or no. It's if photography is art and you want it to be art, or if photography is art and you don't want it to be art, so you're disappointed, and it's if photography is not art and you're glad that it is, and if photography is not art and you wish it were. You see? So it's the same with functionalism in a way. So I'm sort of fascinated by the theory problem, and what I like is that I can justify this as not just a projection on the work by saying that you're quite right in your generalization. And you obviously read more about it than I have, but from what I've read, I can tell that, for example, Kretjar, the Olympia building, which is sort of doggedly symmetrical, but it's a beautiful building.
Right.
But if I told Yaroslav that it's beautiful, he'd probably say, I better go back and do something. Yeah, I better fix it. There must be something wrong if the critics said that it's a beautiful. There must be something left there of that, you know, the contaminated bourgeois aesthetic stuff. I mean, I like the rigor of it,
but
I like the way every time it seems. And don't forget that in parentheses here, they always are looking back to Corbusier's Vers une architecture, because they were sort of like, there's a sort of Oedipal experience there, because they were really stimulated by that book when they were young, and they thought, oh, freedom, at last, you know? And then they realized that he was kind of a sellout in a way. So from that point on, they're always on guard, because I should put a footnote in here, that in English-speaking culture, this problem has been completely obscured. Because this is like the problem that Bruno Bettelheim explored with the translation of Freud, where he said every time that the word Geist is used, it's translated as mind. And so nobody ever knows it, for it is half the time talking about spirit, you know? Well, the equivalent in this is that in Vers une architecture of Corbusier, look at the title. The official title in English is Towards a New Architecture. Vers une architecture means towards an architecture at all, you know? At all, you know? And similarly, every time, this is, you know, the most famous line in the book is, a house is a machine for living. But the example he gives is that the Parthenon, what is the verb that he uses? The Parthenon is a machine à émouvoir. That's an emotion machine, you see? That, and architecture, the definition of it given in that book, is the correct and magnificent play of forms in light. And so this thing arrived on the scene as cool, functionalist, practical, you know, get the job done thing. And then they realized, oh, it has this aesthetic and even metaphysical aspect. But that's just what they were disappointed by when it turned out that he was sort of a sellout and designed that big monumental project, you know, Mundaneum, which was just like, you know. Oh, that's nice. That's very nice. Thanks. And I know that there's beauty in the Czech functionalism. And I just don't want to spoil it. Okay. Any other questions? Well, thanks very much. Mm-hmm.